This is the Division 2, Division 3 podcast.
Welcome to a special Midsummer Division 3 podcast. Today, we're talking the new rules in men's NCAA lacrosse. Our first guest has been vocal about his opinions on the shot clock and other rule changes. Chris Przinski, the head coach at Elizabethtown, shares his thoughts on what they mean for D3 and why he thinks a cautious approach is necessary. Przinski has led Elizabethtown to back-to-back NCAA tournaments, coached in a national championship game as an assistant at Lynchburg, and was a D1 assistant at Richmond. Next, myself and Josh Davey talk about some coaching news in D3 and break down our early picks of teams that are going to make waves in 2019. Then, with so much talk about the shot clock and zone defense, we figured we'd talk to the expert, reigning national championship coach John Raba. He talks with IL's Kyle Devitt about the shot clock, what he thinks teams will do to capitalize on the new rules, the challenges with the NESCAC fall, and how he's sharing his insight with others about the zone D. Be sure to listen to all of this week's podcast breaking down the new rules, including an interview with Nazareth coach and rules committee chair Rob Randall.
It's been a monumental week with what happened in NCAA men's lacrosse with the shot clock. Coach, ahead of the rules committee meetings, you were pretty active on Twitter, skeptical of a shot clock. You know, I know there's a lot of survey data that said the majority of coaches want this. But heading into this meeting, you know, knowing your opinion, knowing your peers' opinion, knowing the survey data, what were you expecting to come out of this rules committee?
Heading into the meeting, there's a little bit of unknowns because the shot clock is so new. I was expecting nothing. I was expecting something. But I think my biggest reaction as to when it happened was it didn't surprise me that we made such a drastic change. And I don't know my gut reaction if the change was the best for the sport, but it's the change that we need to make, and all of our jobs now is to figure out the unknowns of how to put a quality brand of lacrosse on the field with the athletes that we have.
Now that the rules are announced, you know, you said you were a little bit of disappointment. What particularly are you most disappointed in the new rules? And I'm assuming that's particular to the shot clock.
Well, I'm going to give the committee credit is that there was a unanimous agreement on that committee and to make a change. And they made, I think, the biggest one that we could have made. So if you're going to do it, go all in. And I give the committee credit for that. My big disappointment was that I think we've created a ton of questions and fewer answers. I think you mentioned what I was tweeting about a little bit last week, and you know, I had a little bit of buyer's remorse on some of the things because I'm not the biggest Twitter guy, but my understanding of why everyone was pushing for a shot clock was to take subjectivity out of officiating on what was considered a stall and what was considered not, and when a shot clock should be administered in the last 2 years of the rules. I think that everyone wants an ideal game, a clear game, and a game where people aren't screaming for something in a ref's ear and now the ref has to make a decision. But I believe that we were spending dollars to save pennies to create, to bottle up one monster. I think there's a potential to create some other monsters. And that was my initial kind of a reaction to what the rules came out with.
So, Coach P, would you have been more comfortable with a 90 or even 80-second shot clock put on possession instead of a 20-second across the midline and then 60-second shot clock? Would the time or the change of possession with a longer shot clock been something you would have been more comfortable with immediately?
Yeah, with specificity to the rules that were proposed to go to the NCAA committee next month, I would have been a little bit more comfortable with a team gets possession and now you're incentivized to get it down the field quicker for more opportunities to create offense, you know, more opportunities to become a little bit more organized. We don't need the most organized things. This is not football where it's 11 across the line of scrimmage. but an incentive to get across the line quicker, to generate offense quicker, instead of 20 and then a reset at 60. My biggest thing when I heard 60 seconds was that is a pretty condensed amount of time. And I think that scoring a goal is the hardest thing to do in our sport. I think scoring a goal is the most important thing that is in our sport. That's why it's a stoppage of play when a goal is scored. That's why there's celebrations when a goal is scored. That's why you can't win a game 0-0. You have to score. And I think that condensing the amount of time the offense can have the ball to generate a shot adds a defenseman to the other team. It's not only 6 versus 6 in the half field setting. It's 7 versus 6 because there's a goalie, and now you're adding a 60-second shot clock that can add as that eighth defender. That was kind of my gut reaction from going 20 to 60. And I just think scoring goals is what everybody wants, and I'm just hoping that we didn't open up another can of worms that defenses are going to try to manipulate things to make the difficulty of scoring a goal even harder.
A lot of the things that people say heading into these are, we don't know the unintended consequences. You look at something like the substitution box. I think that had an unintended consequence, you know, when that was just a few years ago, lengthened, and now they shortened that this year. You mentioned, you know, maybe defense being able to take over because of, you know, an unintended consequence of the shot clock. What are maybe some other, you know, unintended, unforeseen consequences that you're kind of playing out in your head right now of what might be the result, even though it's not the intended result?
No, I think that there's so many things that coaches are debating about right now, communicating about how are you going to plan for this. I just read an article this morning from Inside the Cross from Patrick McEwen about all these unintended consequences. Matt, I think the thing that you say is what bothers me the most. It was 6 years ago that we made the decision to open up the box. Now, 6 years later, because it didn't work out the way we wanted to, we're bringing it back in. And I'm not going to act like the smartest guy in the world, but if we're going to be a little cavalier and make these changes in our sport that, you know, could make a drastic impact, like I said, it could make an unbelievable impact, but we just don't know yet. But is there a way to establish a data set, a sample size? Is there a way for us to, you know, witness and coach a game in a setting or play the fall ball out with these rules and then vote them on for the 2020 season? And if you love them out of the fall, well, then maybe you go push them for 2019. But could you then vote for them for 2020 instead of now everybody at the Division III level, at least, has 16 practices to try to recreate this new game for the fall and figure out what it's going to mean for them. And 16 practices, if everyone goes 2 hours a day, you have 32 hours to really see what kind of the what ifs. I just wish that there was a way to create a data set, whether it's through the summer recruiting events, whether it's having a trial period through a non-traditional season. We did that last year. We went 60 seconds on possession to go back and forth. I thought it was a great barometer to figure out who could play fast, but there was also a lot of head-scratching moments as to, do I really want that ball rolled into the corner? It was that exciting that every other possession was a average shot or held to no shot or a turnover without a shot. The unintended consequences are unknown. It's humbling how many coaches I've talked to the last 24 hours and their ideas on a zone versus pressure to eat up clock. Using the 20-second clear clock is not a clearing clock, a subbing clock. And then once you get over the midline, now you have 60 seconds to play offense with offensive players. We don't know how it's going to affect each institution and each program, because each program has different personnel, has different beliefs. But I think there is a potential to see some things in the game that really weren't accounted for. And I wish that we would have, done something as a group to have some reconnaissance, if you will, before turning things over on its head to avoid potentially having the vote in 2 years, 90 seconds on possession, if that makes sense.
Coach, you mentioned fall ball, and I know the rules only came out on Friday, or the rule changes. We actually spoke with Coach Childs from York yesterday, and he's already pushed back his fall. He was actually going to start before the September 12th date, which is when the NCAA would or would not, you know, actually move these rules and make them official, so to speak. So given that Friday is when the news came out or broke, is there anything in that short time? I know we were together for most of the weekend, and you mentioned sleeping in your bed for the first time, but is there anything that you've already thought about in terms of how that changes prep for the fall and the calendar in the fall? Do you throw the playbook out in terms of what you had sort of already had scheduled? Do you sort of start from scratch? What are the things that you're thinking about as you head to fall and get those freshmen and see the guys again on campus?
I'm really glad you asked that, because that has been the, as the head coach, and my job is to put my guys in a position to have the best product on the field for them to be successful and hopefully outscore an opponent. Typically the goals of the fall, at Elizabethtown College was to be, let's teach the game, and advance the fundamentals and teach how to develop themselves in the out of season. I was so excited to work with my younger guys on the mechanics of shooting, you know, with some things I took from Coach Chamati leaving Richmond. I was so excited to, you know, teach the ways where we can become more explosive on the field from an athletics standpoint, and what I learned from Coach Tedelka and whatnot at Lynchburg. Now I feel that all that goes out the window, because now we just need to play to figure out what this is ultimately going to look like and how are we going to align our guys to be able to succeed with these new rules. So things that, you know, I really, in the fall, we haven't put in a offense. We haven't put in a defense. We've spent all of our times on enhancing the fundamentals of our individual players and putting them in positions so that they can learn the positive reasons why to do these things correctly in the off season, so that we have more rehearsed guys come the spring. We'll worry about the X's and O's come, you know, March and April when we're all lined up. But we will, but now we have to figure out, what is this game actually going to look like? Is 60 seconds enough time to get a sub with a shortened box? And what is going to happen if a team goes to a zone? And now we're going to scrimmage an extra person and hire officials. So to Coach Childs's point, you know, and I'm glad I'm not the only one that's trying to ripping up the calendar here. It makes me feel like I did at least one thing right in the last 48 hours. But it has changed. And I mean, you look at the NESCAC, they don't even have a fall ball. They're going to be, they start practice February 15th and they got a game on March 1st. We have 16 days in the fall and about 3.5 weeks preseason. There's always going to be growing pains, and some of those growing pains could yield to positive results. But there's a lot more questions than answers right now, because we have not seen this body of lacrosse and these rules be played before.
Coach, I'm going to play devil's advocate here for a second and challenge you on some of these things. First of all, are these new rules, you know, something that might just be bad for Elizabethtown, or do you feel like they might be bad for the sport as a whole? And second, does all of these, you know, you're talking about all these unforeseen consequences that are going to come up and how different coaches are going to deal with it. That also sounds pretty exciting in some way as well, in terms of, we don't necessarily know what the product of lacrosse is going to be, and we could see some really unique and interesting things out there.
Matt, I completely agree. I completely agree that there is opportunity that we could have this unbelievable growth and see some people and athletes put in opportunities to take the game to a whole nother level. You know, my resistance to a drastic type of changes is, was there a way to get a data set, market research, things so that we have some of these questions answered before we have to go and put the class of 2019 at every level in a guinea pig situation. I don't think that these rules hurt Elizabethtown at all. At the end of the day, you know, the athletes are going to dictate where this sport's going to go. My resistance to it is I do not think the 2018 season and brand of lacrosse was in dire need of drastic changes. If you watch the Gettysburg versus Salisbury semifinal game with two top five programs in all of Division III, it was an unbelievable lacrosse game. The final score was 8-7, but it was two extremely athletic and aggressive defenses playing against two very, very rehearsed and fundamentally sound and, you know, teams going to the goal offenses. I don't know if that's a brand of lacrosse that we need to rip up to take out, you know, a couple people yelling in the stands, you know, to put on the shot clock, put on the shot clock. There's going to be human error in all officiating. In the NCAA tournament of Georgetown versus Hopkins, one team had seven guys on the field, and an official couldn't see it 20 yards away. And that doesn't get called. So it's we have these imperfect things in our sport, but I just don't know why recreate something that's growing at such a great rate to go with so many unknowns altogether. As I said, Matt, and as you pointed to, there is opportunity. There's absolutely opportunity. But is there a way that we can be a little bit more researched in our answer, in our decision making from a lacrosse level? That's just a little bit how my brain operates. I don't need or want to control everything. I think guys that have played for me would say that same thing. But from an administrative and governance point, and are we? I just felt like. We have potential for more questions than answers.
Coach, this next question doesn't necessarily apply to Elizabethtown specifically, but in a lot of those early season games, you see a top 10 team playing a lower tier team. And I say it doesn't apply to you because a Landmark is really competitive. You guys are obviously an NCAA tournament team. You play a really tough schedule, but you guys are always competing. But some of those games, you'll see a Salisbury or a team in the beginning of the season playing a team, and there's a goal disparity of you know, 15 or 16 goals. Do you think this rule makes that 16 goal disparity a 24, or does it make it smaller? Does it make the better teams beat teams by that many more, or does it make it closer? Do you think there'll be some games for some of the lower tier Division III teams that could be 4-2? Because that, to your point earlier, that 60 seconds is not a lot of time. You have to be really efficient with your shots. So I'm just interested in what your thoughts are and how it affects some of the teams that, or the games, I guess, that have a larger disparity. Does that disparity become larger, or does that gap narrow?
My gut would say that it does not bring a final score from a perennial national contender team to a younger, hopefully up and coming team. I do not think it narrows the score. I do not think it closes the scoring gap with the disparity. At the end of the day, this is a clock that says how long you can have the ball on offense. That doesn't mean that a quality shot to score a goal is going to break the goal line. To get a quality shot and to score in this game of lacrosse is not as easy as it is to get a ball to a guy that can shoot it outside the three-point line over a defense and into an unguarded hoop. You know, at the end of our day, this is a amount of seconds you have to register something of quality, and shots on goal percentage and then shooting percentage, those get smaller and smaller. And when you give more things in favor of the defense, in my opinion. So I do not know yet. I think at the end of the day, and this goes back to just my general belief in the game of lacrosse, that the most fundamentally sound team in pivotal moments that, you know, are fresh at the end of the year, that they have more good than bad happen to them. It's the execution of a ground ball in a tight spot and putting that pass on the ear. It's the execution of stepping the right way or holding the pipe on a near pipe save and then putting a ball on the ear on the outlet. Those are what's going to win games. And those teams that are the most rehearsed in that or continue going to win games. I think this clock now puts a shock collar on offenses to get something done with efficiency. In a shorter amount of time. Like I said, I think the shot clock could potentially be used as an ace defender. And so I don't know. You know, we lose to Gettysburg 15-3. I don't think it was because of lack of stalling on Elizabethtown or on Gettysburg. I think that, you know, they were the deeper and better team, and you know, we had didn't play our best, and that's what you're going to get at whether there's a 60-second, 90-second, or no second shot clock. It's about your guys playing their best at the right time, and now us as coaches have to find a way to do that with an unknown set of rules.
Just one more, sort of an overall Division III landscape and how this rule affects it. My opinion is, you know, sort of just talking to some other coaches is, you know, this may hurt a team like Salisbury when you look at how many shots they take a game. They're very efficient with their shots, and putting a time constraint on that could affect them more so than other teams. Like a Stevenson, who might take 65 shots a game, I think this rule, you know, lends itself and makes a team like Stevenson, who wins faceoffs and, you know, takes 65 shots a game, it helps them a lot more because they're used to taking that many shots. And so that's just one point. And then another, you know, with not a lot of, you know, in the Division III South specifically, a lot of top goalies returning. You look at a lot of the top teams and they graduate a senior goalie. You know, there's a few examples that don't necessarily back up that comment, but just overall D3 with this rule, what are the things that you're most excited about this season?
Oh, Josh, you threw a lot out there because I think I can make an argument that, you know, I don't know if this necessarily hurts a Salisbury. I think that Coach Berkman is a great enough coach that he's going to find a way to generate a higher quality shot in that time frame. That's, you know, that's for what us coaches right now are in our staff meetings talking about and thinking about what personnel we have to put them in the right positions. I think what isn't being talked about is that a shot doesn't necessarily mean a shot on goal, and a shot on goal doesn't necessarily mean a goal. And so that, I'm afraid that we've, you know, spent dollars to save pennies to get officials out of what a shot clock is and to speed the game up, and we don't know the unintended consequences. My thing is, and I'm not going to make a lot of friends with this statement, but I said it earlier, I don't know if we needed to recreate the 2018 game, but at least from my personal experience in playing this game, and a lot of the advocates in the MLL and the coaches in the ML that are celebrating this game was, you know, I personally, you know, never liked playing pickup or club ball. I never was an MLL player, never will be, but a little bit of organization, a little bit of, you know, structure, I felt that, you know, I enjoyed playing in that. And I think that as long our coaches are going to need to be able to handle some more turnovers and some more things that we would previously have our heads scratching. Was that a quality shot? If it's a possession save and now you're breaking it out over the field to a long pole that can handle it. Like, if that's what the sport wants to go to and that's what the majority wants, then that's fine. You know, I get that. But if we are putting this in to take officiating, you know, subjectivity out of it and to try to equal the playing field, I don't necessarily know if that's a good reason for us to make such a drastic change. But what I'm looking forward to the most, Josh and Matt, is there's some unbelievable people, some unbelievably smart coaches. There's some just people that are so passionate about the game. You know, how do they turn this all into a positive? Because at the end of this phone call, I don't pound my desk and I go tweet out that, you know, this is malarkey, this is going to set the game back. No, it's going to be me thinking about the, you know, all of my returners that I have and my 16 freshmen coming in. How am I going to put them in the best positions to succeed? And and make this game, you know, still fun, entertaining, and as a rewarding of an experience that I had as a student athlete. I loved my experience as a student athlete on and off the field. I love facilitating that for my guys now. Now it's our job as coaches to take this new parameters and put them in a best position to succeed. And it's that simple. At the end of the day, the great coaches are going to find this to make them work, not for the rules, not for the officials, not for the opinions, but for their players. The great coaches are going to make this work for the guys in their locker room and putting them in the best spots, and that's going to be fun to watch. A rule is not going to dictate how a game's going to be played. The players are going to be dictating how this game is going to be played, and that's what we got to do. So that's what we would do from here on out, and figuring out what we're going to do with the time that we have to make the most informed decisions that we can.
Josh, that was a fantastic conversation with Coach Przinski there. Looking at the shot clock, and you know, some of it's maybe a different opinion than we've heard from some of the other coaches who have been, you know, more staunchly in support of the shot clock. Bottom line is, we don't necessarily know exactly what's going to happen. Anyone who says they know exactly what's going to happen is lying or just overly confident and cocky. But we'll see. It's exciting at the least to kind of have this little mystery of what's going to happen in the 2019 season. What we do know is there has been some big D3 kind of moving and shaking in terms of the coaching carousel this offseason. You know, there's a few really, really good jobs that are still open. A rundown of some of, not all of the jobs that have the coaching hires from this year. RPI, Scott Hackett Dagliesh hired there, Ursinus, Gary Mercandanti, Skidmore, Joe Martin from North Carolina is taking the head coaching position there. At Guilford, Mark Crisco is the interim head coach. Frostburg, Tommy Pierce left Frostburg. This is a really interesting job here. You know, there's the talk that they're going to go Division II, so Coach Pierce left there. Aurora, Kyler Berkman, he left. You know, he's taking a job kind of in the private sector, so to speak, I believe with 3D Lacrosse, and he's going to be coaching with them, and Reed Mayberry replaces him. Adrian College, Babson, other universities that have some new head coaches. The two that we're going to focus on a little bit is Montclair State. You know, unfortunately, the passing of Mike Schambeck is left an opening there that, you know, the head coaching job that needs to be filled. And Haverford, just recently, you know, Brendan Dawson stepping down there. These are two really good jobs that are open really late in the season, aren't they, Josh?
Yeah, they are. And it's interesting, you know, the late in the season thing has a big factor because I think there's a lot of coaches who would have been interested in these jobs 2 or 3 months ago. But now, as guys are coming back on campus, you know, guys are – the coaches, I feel like, are really dug into what they got right now. It's hard to make a switch. But Haverford and Montclair State are two great opportunities. Obviously, you know, it's terrible that there's an opening at Montclair State. Our hearts go out to that community. And the whole Division III lacrosse community is certainly thinking about you guys. You know, that's a great opportunity for someone who will be really lucky to step in those shoes. You know, it's in a great area in New Jersey. It's very recruitable. And I think Haverford is the most interesting. Brendan Dawson leaves to coach at, you know, the Haverford School, right down the road, the high school Haverford School, you know, a national powerhouse. Haverford College made the Centennial Conference Tournament this year. They made it over, you know, teams like Washington College. What Coach Dawson had done there in his short time was amazing. And I think because of the academic standards at Haverford, the teams that are going to consistently compete in the Centennial Conference are the ones that have those higher academic standards. You know, Haverford is one of the best liberal arts schools in the entire country, competing with the Tufts, you know, the NESCAC, Middlebury schools. So if you can get the right guys there, you know, it's in a great area, beautiful, you know, sort of like Main Line, Pennsylvania. You can get the right guys there, and people are going to want to go there with the right person, given the athletics, playing in a great conference, and then also, you know, the unbelievable chance to get an amazing job after school. So the right person goes there, and that team can be in 4 years, couple years, could be competing for a Centennial Conference Championship, no doubt in my mind. So that is a really interesting one. But again, I think the caveat is, it's late. Who's going to leave something they know that's pretty, you know, sure right now, given that it's August 14th, you know, when they're going to see their guys in 2 weeks go somewhere completely new. So it's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, the analogy that I heard for Haverford, you know, was, you know, just a few years ago, they were kind of on the same path as Wesleyan. So that's, you know, some pretty high praise right there. Josh, you know, we just heard from Coach Przinski, and we've been talking a lot in the office about, you know, what do these rules mean when we finally get down to it and teams have to play games. And like I just said, we don't necessarily know, but I think we can make some guesses of, given what we know about returning personnel, what we know about how teams did last year, what we know about the way teams are and how they might adapt to these new rules. Give me a team that you just expect to, you know, to be a riser next year, to be a team that, that people are going to be talking about next season.
I don't, you know, it depends, right? Riser is a relative term from where these teams are. I kind of have three teams. I just got another one that I think really benefit the most from the rule change, but I think also just have a lot of momentum coming off last year. One is Cabrini. They return essentially everyone. I'm looking at their roster right now, barely see a senior on there. So that's a high, they take a lot of shots, which I think lends itself to this you know, 60-second shot clock. They win faceoffs. They're scrappy. I think that's a team. They're in a new conference this year that I could see to take that jump. You know, they've sort of been a, you know, sort of like a Sweet 16, you know, contender making it to the second round for a long time, you know, as they've dominated that conference. I think that they're one that this could be the year they take the next step forward. The two other ones I think of, and again, these are sort of relative, I think CNU had an amazing year last year. And as we talk about the difference between, you know, and every team's going to be different, whether you're playing a zone, you know, they play this backer zone that has given them a lot of success. They lose, you know, Matt Chris, their top scorer, but they return Dylan Rice, who was a freshman, another freshman who scored 40-plus points. So I think that's a team who already has that fundamental base of a zone. And I think when there's 9-10 seconds left in the shot clock, they go to that and can switch in and out of it. It is a huge advantage for them. So I'm really high on CNU. And the other one that I think, you know, had an underperforming season last year is Stevenson. And I mentioned in the podcast with Coach Brzezinski, I think that they, you know, again, a team with not a lot of senior leadership last year, they have guys now who have sort of knows what it feels like to lose. And I think there's nothing, not a more motivating factor than losing. So I think that this is, you know, going to be a year for Coach Canopy and his squad where they bounce back. You know, the way they play really lends itself to the shot clock, up and down, back and forth. You know, need to get a little more consistent goalie play. You know, but I think that they're a team also that we see make a jump. You know, they lost their first five or six games last year. I think they win one or two of those games this year. So those are the three, Cabrini, CNU, and Stevenson, that I think, you know, are teams to certainly have circled for your calendar next year.
I think it goes without saying, Wesleyan, you know, with the zone, you know, they're obviously the defending champion, so they're kind of disqualified from this conversation. We know what they're all about. But obviously having the zone and having years of experience doing it and being the best at it is certainly something that, you know, if the proliferation of zone defense kind of happens as we expect, they're certainly head and shoulders above everyone else right now. Team that I'm looking at, kind of my early team to watch, is Washington Lee. You know, they have arguably the best player in Division III coming back to them, A.J. Witherall. You know, they've got four of their top six scorers returning to this team. You know, really, if you look at their last season, they had that slow start, but then they just went on a tear that was absolutely phenomenal. They lost to Dickinson in the NCAA tournament, but it was a Dickinson team that I thought was just fantastic. I expect them to be really good with the new rules. They also have a good transfer coming in, Stuart Greenspan from Hobart. He's a lefty that's going to, you know, they're kind of stockpiling lefties at Washington Lee, but, you know, that's good news for them. Then, of course, you know, there's a team, when I think of playing fast, I think of Amherst. This is a team that there's no way that any of their possessions have been over 60 seconds since Coach John Thompson has been there. You know, they're this team that is known to play fast. They've been successful at it. They've been able to play, the defense has been able to hold on enough and kind of outscore teams with, you know, how good its offense is. They're just returning basically all of their scoring. You know, you get down to, it's like their 13th guy on the roster had 17 points, and that's the first senior that you get on this roster. I'm worried that just they're a little bit attack heavy, and I'm not sure if they necessarily have the midfielders who can kind of, you know, go both ways and do it, but well, that'll be seen. But I really like the way that they're just kind of built for this shot clock and with everything that they have returning and just with, you know, the end of their season, they lost to York in the NCAA tournament. They're going to come back fired up. I think we're going to see some really big things out of them.
I think it's so funny, and this sort of echoes Coach Brzezinski's point earlier that, you know, the teams we talk about for next season, ones to keep an eye on, are all teams that made the NCAA tournament. So I think, you know, to sort of tie a bow on this, at the end of the day, the rules are going to change, yes, but the best teams still have are the best teams because they're the best players and the best coaches. So regardless of what the rules, well, you know, how they change for, you know, next year or the year after, whatever it may be, you know, those top teams are the top teams because they have the best players and the best coaches. So I think at the end of the day, every single coach is going to figure out what works best for their guys, and players make plays. So, you know, whether it's within 60 seconds or it's, you know, with a stall or whatever it is, I think that the teams that are at the top are going to stay there. You know, there's going to be little tweaks. There'll be little areas where you can catch up and gain ground, and you might lose some ground. But, you know, that's why we love this game, is it's a player's game. And at the end of the day, they're the ones on the field who get to make those decisions. And watching them make those decisions in a shorter time, you know, is going to be a lot of fun to watch. So I'm really, really looking forward to this next season for Division III. You know, a lot on the table, a lot at stake. And just seeing how this rule affects it, I think it will, you know, it's going to make a lot of, it's going to make some differences, but at the end of the day, those top teams are going to be the top teams. So just echoing Coach P's point and the teams we just mentioned, you know, nothing really says it more than those comments.
Coach John Raba, 2018 Division III champion with Wesleyan Lacrosse. How are we today?
Great, Kyle. Great.
All right. We just wanted to get some of your thoughts on the initial rule changes, and I guess the best place to start is with that most general question, which, what are your initial thoughts?
You know, it's funny, my initial thoughts on it all is to try to be patient and see how things start to look in the fall with a lot of Division I programs. You know, we have some of our own thoughts, but the secondary problem within the net, we can't coach our players in the fall, you know? So even if we had some ideas and wanted to try to implement some stuff, like, we have to be, you know, that has to happen in February when we can get with the team, you know? Obviously we can have a conversation about what we're looking for, but, and let them try to do some things. But for me, you know, we want to almost take a step back and see what other teams are doing, you know? So we're certainly going to plan to visit some people and try to get some different ideas and get a look at it firsthand. Obviously the MLL's got, you know, their version of the shot clock, and but you know, for us, it's going to almost to do what the opposite of whatever he's probably going to do is, you know, trying to throw a lot of different things out there and see what sticks. You know, for us, is try to evaluate what they're doing and then try to come up with some kind of game plan that our guys can work on in the fall, and then really implement really once we get rolling in the spring.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you say that you're going to go out and see what other people are doing. I would think that with the news of the shot clock, everyone's brought up playing zone a lot more, and people would be reaching out to you, banging your door down. Have you found that yet?
Yeah, there's been definitely a large, you know, amount of coaches who've you know, reached out and are looking to talk about the zone, particularly in the fall. And I'm happy to do that, you know, with coaches. I'm always happy to help people out and talk about what we do. It's going to be interesting. You know, I think one of the challenges we're going to have with the new rule is basically going to be, you know, we always felt comfortable when we had our full complement of, you know, two short stick D-mids and our long stick in there. We could really get into our zone. You know, offenses were willing to kind of set things up and try to be patient with the ball, and we can get the personnel in, and then we could kind of fall into it. Where now, you know, it's going to be pressed a little bit more on us, and we're going to have to go with some of our offensive players actually really learning what to do on the defensive side and taking some real ownership and the nuances and the little things that we took for granted, I think, with a lot of our D-mids. Now those offensive kids are going to have to really understand those nuances. And again, those are conversations, I think, as we talk to coaches and how we can slip in and out of things. You know, we'll pick up some different ideas too and thoughts just by, you know, some of the conversations we'll have in the fall. So I'm happy to do that. And I'm excited for it because it's going to help us think a little bit more outside the box of how we can get set up with things and kind of maximize what we're trying to do as a group.
How do you expect, let's just say, teams in your conference to combat the shot clock, or just teams in Division III in general? What do you think their first move is?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first move is to try to really exploit this quick, you know, the very first 10 seconds of possession, you know, coming down and a willingness to really kind of shoot early and take some shots, maybe even if they're not the, you know, a little bit more high volume on the shots. You know, teams like Amherst have done that this past year. RIT is really known to do that, really try to get into their, you know, the quick offense early, you know, so you're going to see a lot of games as they come through that midfield line is where they're going to, you know, you know, pass down, pick down from up top, like try to get exploit some 4-and-4, 5-and-5 situations. You know, I think they're going to try to generate those things on the earlier side, actually, of the shot clock. Because again, if the longer they're going to wait, I just believe it's going to fall. The advantage starts to become swing to our side in terms of, you know, just the overall, they're running out of time situation. So it's not going to get a good shot, you know. So it's, you know, well known is your best opportunities to score are going to be, you know, with less numbers, you know, on the field. So if we're, you know, if we want to try to be maximize what we're trying to do on defense, again, that's going to take some of our offensive guys now to really, again, really play a lot more defense, you know. I'd be willing to kind of stay in there and make sure that we, you know, don't give them those opportunities. Again, if every team decides to do, you know, that, again, it's not going to go that well. I think you have to be pretty skilled to really push the ball and have some really great shooters, or it can be frustrating. You know, particularly in the early offense. But if they have some pretty good offenses, you know, and got some really good shooters, I mean, it's going to put some more pressure on our goalies to make some saves, I can tell you that, because they're going to see more shots, no doubt.
What do you think the biggest impact the rule changes will have is on all Division III as a whole, from top to bottom?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, this is, if you look at the top end, you know, there's a big gap there between the top end Division III schools and maybe the lesser Division III schools, just in terms of their level of play and that their stick handling and just their, you know, it's getting definitely the numbers growing and we're staying in a bigger pack with the quality. But some of the lesser teams, the only negative I think would be is I just don't know. So some of the teams are quite ready for, you know, that type of offense. You know, it could look pretty ugly at times, you know, and that's what I'm assuming is going to happen, where teams are just coming down. It's just, it turns into a one-on-one situation, and guys don't care if they get doubled or tripled. They just feel like they want to get these shots off. And again, that's probably the one thing, I think, as a whole, where I think the top-end Division III schools are going to have, you know, a pretty good game plan. It's going to work well. They're going to have skilled enough players to really, you know, they can shoot from a further distance. Maybe some of the lesser programs don't have a guy that could really rip the ball from 15 or 13 yards. And again, that means they're going to be trying to run through, you know, a lot of sticks. And so I think that's where some of that's going to be interesting to see as the year goes on, how teams are dealing with it. If we're talking about the entire landscape, I think that's going to be the biggest thing, where I think at times it's going to look really fun and fast, and then you can watch another game. And it could look really ugly and sloppy. So, you know, that's part of the challenge.
All right, Coach Rabo, thanks for joining us, and congratulations again on your championship.
I appreciate it, Kyle, and looking forward to working with you guys throughout the fall.
This is the Division II, Division III podcast.